Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are many people who are observers of this war for the free world. There are few who I think do it with more effect than our first guest. He is Peter Husey. He is the president of Geostrategic Analysis and a man who I have come to believe is extraordinarily thoughtfully engaged in bringing an awful lot of other people to understand the challenges of our time, notably through a series of remarkable breakfasts and lunches and similar events that he holds in Washington, D.C. to expose policymakers, congressional staff, and others to the serious challenges of our time, and in particular, the importance of nuclear and other forms of deterrence in that regard. Peter Husey, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank, very much again for inviting me to come and talk to you.
Always a pleasure. Let me ask you first about this strike in Syria. I know you've been thinking about it, and I gather writing about it as well. President Trump, of course, moved over the weekend with the British and the French to attack three targets in Syria in connection with their chemical weapons program in retaliation for what have been alleged to be regime attacks using these things recently in parts of Syria. Talk to me about that attack, how effective you think it was. Will it deter such chemical weapons use by the Syrian regime in the future?
Well, thanks, Frank. I think we now have we see the consequences of 8 years plus of leading from behind, strategic patience, retreat, you call it what you will. It has a real effect on deterrence. The other guy doesn't take you seriously. And then the question is, how do you build up deterrence? How do you let the bad guys know you're serious? This is an attempt to not only do that, but the treaty itself, the chemical weapons treaty of which we're a party, requires its members to take action, even unilateral action and military action, to put back in the box, so to speak, folks that violate the treaty, which the Syrians have done. They're the only ones that can deliver this stuff, either by fixed-wing aircraft or helicopter. And we are basically, we're drawing a line in the sand, a red line, but we're also enforcing it at the same time. Time will tell whether or not this will keep Assad from using these weapons again. You don't know that one way or the other, as you know, in terms of security policy. But it had to be done because otherwise we're giving him a license to use these things without restraint.
Yeah. Peter, there's a lot to talk about there. We will come back to it, I think, in the future. But let me segue to another topic that I know is on your mind and mine. A country that has apparently been involved in helping the Syrians with their chemical weapons program is North Korea. You've spent a lot of time on the Korean Peninsula and thinking about this regime in Pyongyang. Talk to us a little bit about what it is doing and the prospects for a useful summit between President Trump and the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un.
Well, thanks, Frank. I've been fascinated by a series of, I've collected 19 such editorials, essays, or news articles saying that North Korea, when it says denuclearization, doesn't really mean denuclearization. Now, this is news to President Clinton, President Bush, and President Obama, all of whom in one form or another were working to try to, some less successful course than others, to get rid of the nuclear weapons in North Korea. And now we're being told that it doesn't, when Kim says denuclearization doesn't mean that. This is not new. It is this town is a strange way, Frank, of they basically laid out talking points for the North Koreans. Sanctions don't work. China doesn't have enough influence over the North. Military force won't work. Diplomacy is the only answer. And what do they come up with? A nuclear freeze, which is basically cementing North Korea's nuclear program, and basically they would be a new nuclear power. And that's crazy. But as soon as it's apparent that Trump will sit down with this guy and say, okay, are you going to get rid of your nukes or not? And they're terrified that if the North Koreans say, no, we're not going to get rid of our nukes, Trump will say, well, our military is over here, our intelligence folks are over here, see ya, and leave. On the other hand, Kim may be frightened enough to say, oh, yes, we will have a plan to get rid of our nuclear weapons. Now, I think the former will happen rather than the latter. But the fact is that Trump is doing this meeting to get an answer. And that answer is, will you or will you not put on a table the plan, a plan that's real and verifiable and serious to get rid of your nuclear weapons? And I think people miss what Trump has been doing. So I think what he's trying to do is get an answer of, okay, let's find out what the lay of the land is. Are the North Koreans going to be serious about the 21 promises they have made in the past about getting rid of nukes? And if not, that tells us a great deal that negotiations in that case will just lead to what I call nuclear rope-a-dope, which means they'll build missiles and build nukes while we're talking, and the problem will get worse. And that, to me, is why this administration is laying out the policy it is, which is, let's find out the answer to this. I think you know it, and I think I know it, but I think getting it on the table and by Kim himself will finally get rid of this foolishness of pretending that there's a diplomatic deal here somewhere. Then we're going to face some very tough decisions.
Yeah, we're going to face tough decisions, I think, no matter what, Peter, you're right. But let me just ask you, the useful idiots, as you've called them, that harking back to a term that Lenin coined, I believe, are playing a role. And as far as I understand what you're saying, they are effectively undermining President Trump at a moment when he's trying to get this clarity, and he's trying to make sure that the world is on notice that if the North Koreans don't mean the obvious meaning of denuclearization, that they are going to be accountable and responsible for what follows. Is that right?
Well, you're exactly right. I find this fascinating that if you took the American media and essays and news stories and laid out what their themes were, every one of the themes are basically North Korea needs nukes because of the hostile U.S. policy. China can't help us out because they don't have enough juice. Sanctions won't work, and military force won't work. The only thing you can do is negotiate basically on the terms of the North, because if they don't like things and get upset, they'll use thousands of artillery tubes and launch attack on South Korea and Seoul, which, by the way, we're told over and over that will work. So we're told North Korea has military options, but we don't. And so we're basically in a cul-de-sac of the other guys got all the chips. And it's fascinating to me is you have people who, on the one hand, say getting rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons is really, really important. I mean, if you go back the last since the 1994 agreed framework, they said this was a serious threat. And they're always talking about Los Angeles maybe going up in smoke. Well, then we turn around and see, well, wait a minute. You're now telling us there's really no choice but to let North Korea have nuclear weapons.
We have to leave it at that, Peter Husey, for today. This is a subject we will return to, though, as the summit that we are told will happen between President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un approaches in May. Thanks for the work you do, my friend. Keep it up. We'll talk with you again very soon. Suzanne Schulte joins us next. We'll do a deeper dive on North Korea right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of my favorite people, Suzanne Schulte, the president of the Defense Forum Foundation and the vice co-chair of the U.S. Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. She is also the honorary chairman of a tremendously important operation, Free North Korea Radio, and the honorary co-chairman, as I understand it, of the 15th annual North Korean Freedom Week, which will get underway in another 10 days or so. Suzanne Schulte, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. It's great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Frank.
So tell us a little bit about North Korea Freedom Week. As I say, you've been involved in this, and it's been going on for a decade and a half now. How have things changed on the ground in North Korea, and what are you seeing happening there now that makes this initiative so much more important?
Well, North Korea Freedom Week began in 2004. It was an event we put together on Capitol Hill to rally support at the time for the North Korea Human Rights Act, because back then the human rights atrocities were being committed in North Korea were just completely being ignored for the sake of engagement and trying to negotiate with North Korea to end their nuclear program. It seems like the same thing going on today. But basically, that was the first North Korea Freedom Day in April 28th. It was the largest gathering at the time of Americans for the passage of the North Korea Human Rights Act. We had over 1,000 people gather on Capitol Hill. But the situation continued to be dire. So we expanded to a week. We've been doing it every week faithfully at the end of April to focus specifically on the freedom, human rights, and dignity of the North Korean people. And this particular North Korea Freedom Week, we're especially focusing attention on what the North Korean defectors are doing, which is one of the strongest weapons we have for peaceful change in North Korea, because it's the defectors that are leading the charge in, like, Free North Korea Radio. It's a defector radio program. The rescues, the North Korean defectors have taken on the Underground Railroad and rescuing people. They're getting information through creative means like balloon launches, cross-border transfers. They're basically, this is the theme is the truth will set them free, because the North Korean defectors absolutely believe that if the people of North Korea understood the truth, that things would change overnight in North Korea. In other words, when they realize that Kim Jong-un is not a god, that South Korea is a prosperous nation, that America wants the same kind of freedoms and human rights for the people of North Korea that South Koreans and Americans enjoy, when they understand the truth, their minds completely change.
Let me ask you, Suzanne Schulte, about these defectors. It's been striking to me that they are doing the kind of work you're talking about. This is extremely dangerous stuff, is it not? And it's dangerous just getting to be a defector as well, and it seems increasingly so as the regime of Kim Jong-un has been taking pains to crack down even more, if that's imaginable, on the people of North Korea, especially those seeking to get out of there. Tell us a little bit about the defectors themselves and what they're facing at the moment.
What the Kim Jong-un regime did immediately when he took power in North Korea was he set about a very aggressive way to try to stop people from escaping, so that the number of people coming out has dropped dramatically. There's over 30,000 that have escaped, but it's so much more difficult to get out. And I believe that, you know, that's what is an affirmation, because it's all of these people escaping that have educated us to the point now that there's no doubt about the political prison camps. There's no doubt that crimes against humanity are being committed. It's these eyewitnesses that have told their stories that have made the world recognize that this is a dictator who's committing crimes against humanity. And thus, he does not want people to escape because of that. And he threatens those that do. For example, if there's somebody who's got family members back in North Korea, they're under steady guard and watch because they may have a family member that got to South Korea. So he's very threatened by those that have escaped, because they're the ones that are bearing witness. But they've also taken up the cause. And I can tell you that people that are involved with North Korea Freedom Week are all on Kim Jong-un's assassination list, which again affirms, because what are they doing? All they're doing is getting information in. It may be radio broadcasting, it may be balloon launches, but it just affirms that he's afraid of the truth.
I was struck by the fact that last month, even the UN Human Rights Commission has decided that it's going to expand its mandate, as they say, to look into what's going on in the way of human rights abuses in North Korea at long last. But there's also information getting into the North that is, as you say, potentially game-changing, and it's happening both in ways and at levels that have not been seen before. Is that right?
Absolutely. They estimate that at least 60% of North Koreans are getting access to information beyond the regime's propaganda. And it could be just the leaflets that are going in through the balloon launches, or it could be the shortwave radio program that we do, or the USBs and SDs that defectors are smuggling over the China border. We have to use all these different means because, as you know, North Korea doesn't have regular electricity. So the balloon launches are important because those are leaflets that are coming in with information. The shortwave radio is very important. It can be heard in every part of North Korea, but we don't know how many people actually have radios. So we need to use all these methods to get information in. But it's definitely having an impact. I would say that the people of North Korea are far more educated. I would like to say that the Kim Jong-un's North Korea is not the North Korea of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, because there is so much information that's gone in. And one thing also I think that people need to recognize is that it's the North Korean people themselves that have created the market system it's the reason why they're surviving. The public distribution system, which is how they controlled loyalty to the regime, everything passed through, food, material goods, all passed through this public distribution system, but that completely broke down. And North Korean women started the free markets that have propped up and are really how people are surviving today. The market-based economy was driven by the women trying to survive. So it just shows you the defiance of the people and trying to survive. And that's, to me, the most powerful weapon we have. And we're not utilizing it. And one thing that's really important right now, as you brought up the UN, but now that the UN Commission of Inquiry concluded what the defectors have been telling us for decades, that these crimes against humanity are occurring, atrocious human rights violations, how much more important it is for the government of South Korea and the Trump administration to make human rights a priority in any talks. And I'm very concerned that we've learned that the South Korean government isn't going to raise any human rights issues when they negotiate with them and at the summit that's coming up at the end of April. And this is just outrageous. It's the same mistake that we've been making again and again and again. And I think that Kim Jong-un is well aware that his days are numbered, and now this is his charm offensive to try to save his regime from collapse.
Right. We have, as you say, Suzanne Schulte, seen this movie before. This is exactly what he, to some extent, but certainly his father and his grandfather before him did whenever they got into a real jam, and that was to turn on the charm offensive and use the West, including, I'm sorry to say, if you know this very well, the United States as well, to buy time, to buy concessions in the form of oil or other energy or money or political legitimacy or even food to keep the regime going. It hasn't worked out. At the same time, we keep talking about this is all in the nature of or in the name of trying to reduce the nuclear threat, and yet it has only perpetuated it, alas. Suzanne, is there any reason to believe at this point, as President Trump is moving in the direction of the summit with Kim Jong-un, that we're going to find him subject to the same sorts of pressures and induced to make the same strategic mistake?
I absolutely fear that. I'm very glad that John Bolton is where he is, because I think John Bolton has a real clear view of this. He's the first ambassador at the UN that actually raised the North Korea issues, the human rights issues in North Korea, back when he served at the UN. So I think he's much more clear-eyed about this. But what I worry about is that we fall into this trap, this charm offensive, because we think, oh, I'm going to be the diplomat that solves this issue. And we've seen that play out again and again. The North Koreans know how to manipulate and play us. They play on our good intentions and our goodwill. They don't come to the negotiating table with the same set of standards and guidelines that we have. I really fear that a Trump-Kim summit would further legitimize this regime. You know, when you think about what happened with Assad, would Trump sit down with Assad? I'm very concerned about that, unless significant changes are made. For example, releasing the Americans that are being held, allowing the Red Cross to visit the political prison camps and deliver humanitarian aid, accounting for the abductees. I mean, there's so many things that really should be prerequisites before we sit down with this man, because he is an evil dictator. And I'm afraid that less than that, we end up legitimizing him. This is exactly what he wants. This is going to play great in North Korea, in the brainwashing and the propaganda campaign. But the worst thing about not bringing up human rights in these negotiations and summits is this: it feeds the lie. The lie that Kim Jong-un tells his own people is they have to have nuclear weapons because we want to destroy them. And this lie is further fed when we don't raise our concerns about how the people that are suffering. I would say that is more important than the nuclear issue, because the only reason why this dictator is using all these resources to develop nuclear weapons rather than feed his own people is because it's a dictatorship that has atrocious human rights violations. So in some ways, you could argue the human rights are more important.
Suzanne Schulte, this is an enormously important work you're about. Of course, I congratulate you on the upcoming 15th annual North Korea Freedom Week in Seoul, South Korea. Tell us how people can find out more about that and more generally the work you do, Diane.
Our website is www.defenseforumfoundation.org, and you can learn more about North Korea Freedom Week, but also the radio program we do, Free North Korea Radio, which is a partnership between defectors that are in South Korea that produce the program and Americans who help pay the shortwave transmission. It's a remarkable partnership.
Thank you, Suzanne. We have to leave it at that for today. We'll be back to talk to you afterwards. Thank you so much, and God bless. Next up, we'll have our weekly visit with Gordon Chang about developments in Asia. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being, by Gordon Chang. Basically every week, one of the high points of this program is our visit with him, one of the country's preeminent authorities on Asia, what's happening there, and what it means for all of us. Gordon is contributor to the Daily Beast and National Interest. He is also one of the people whose two important books are required reading: Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. You often see him at Fox News and elsewhere. We're always grateful for his time. Gordon, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
So we've been talking thus far in the program about the various aspects of North Korea and Syria. And I know you have some thoughts, Gordon, on the role that the North Koreans have been playing in the Syrian chemical weapons program. What can you share with us about that?
Well, the North Koreans have been the primary supplier to the Assad regime of chemical weapons since at least the middle of the 1990s. The North Koreans have built two facilities for them, perhaps more. We know that North Koreans in 2007 were killed in Syria when they were loading mustard gas on a Scud missile. And in 2013, North Korean soldiers were spotted near a chemical weapons attack near the city of Aleppo. So we know that the involvement has been long going and certainly has been very important to the Assad regime's ability to use chemical weapons on its own citizens. This is something that we need to talk about. You know, we have, of course, struck the Syrian chemical facilities twice. But we need to discuss how the Syrians are getting their chemical weapons.
No, this is a question of trafficking in these very, very dangerous forms of armaments that I think really requires a much closer scrutiny. And I think personally, it should not be confined to just Syria or even Syria and North Korea, Gordon Chang. It appears as though the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, I think basically every bad guy regime on the planet is maintaining a chemical arsenal, even if they have signed the Chemical Weapons Convention that prohibits it. It's a very ominous state of affairs, especially at a time when the shortcomings of not having our own in-kind deterrence is seemingly, at least in my mind, on display in this this most recent episode in Syria. Gordon, speaking of China, let me ask you about several aspects of Chinese policy that are concerning. The Chinese have, of course, as we've discussed frequently, been engaged in a whole host of trade practices that are deeply problematic, shall we say. They're harmful to our economy. They've displaced the manufacturing base of this country, cut back on employment, and so on. The president has responded to all of this with a somewhat blunt instrument, the use of tariffs. The Chinese have threatened retaliation, and yet Xi Jinping seems to have, as you put it the other day, blinked. Talk a little bit about where you think things stand now with respect to this tariff war, as some have called it. Is it going to happen? And if not, is that because the Chinese have in fact decided they don't want to fight that fight?
Well, Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, seems to have blinked when he talked at the Boao Forum for Asia. This is sort of it's called China Davos. Where he said that he was going to drop China's tariffs on imported vehicles. This was just hours after President Trump tweeted on the subject. And Trump's tweet was essentially that, look, the United States only has a 2.5% tariff on Chinese cars coming into the U.S., whereas China has a 25% tariff on American cars going into China. This is not reciprocal. It's not fair. Our president was certainly correct. China has also signaled further opening of its economy. And I think they're extremely concerned about the Section 301 tariffs that President Trump may impose. We've threatened tariffs on about $150 billion of Chinese goods under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. This is for China's theft of U.S. intellectual property. Nobody likes tariffs, Frank. Yes, they are a blunt instrument, but the Chinese are really leaving us no choice because they're attacking our innovation, and we need to protect it from extremely pernicious Chinese policies. Because if we don't have innovation in our economy, we basically don't have an economy. And if we don't have an economy, we don't have a military. So this is something where we absolutely have to show the Chinese that we are willing to impose those costs worth taking hundreds of billions of dollars, perhaps as much as $600 billion of U.S. IP each year.
Let me ask you about something else. You've just written a piece for the Daily Beast under the headline, Spineless. You talk about Trump's letting China's big banks launder North Korea's cash. Now, I know that there have been some efforts in the past, notably in the Bush administration, and I thought during even this one, Gordon, to signal that Chinese banks wouldn't be allowed to help essentially circumvent or otherwise enable the North Koreans to persist in the practices that we're trying to sanction. And yet you've described a decision evidently taken not to do that with respect to some very big players in this space, the Agricultural Bank of China and China Construction Bank. Tell us what's going on there.
President Trump, June 29th of last year, designated Bank of Dandong a primary money laundering concern under Section 311 of the Patriot Act. That led to Bank of Dandong being disconnected from the global banking system. That was intended as a signal to China to get out of the business of laundering money for North Korea. But we know that the Chinese banks, at least up to December of last year, and probably through this month, have been continuing to handle financial transactions for North Korea and violate U.S. law. This is the bad part. The Trump administration has done virtually nothing to impose costs on China. Those two banks, the second and third largest Chinese banks, have been involved in money laundering. The administration has taken no action against them. It's also taken no action against the first and fourth largest Chinese banks, Bank of China and the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, which have also been laundering money for the North Koreans. We know that, you know, the Bush administration started down that road signaling to the Chinese because they disconnected a small Macau bank that North Korea used for money laundering. The Obama administration imposed fines of hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars on European banks for busting the Iran sanctions. So far, you know, the Trump administration, although it did go after Bank of Dandong as a symbolic symbol, nonetheless has allowed wholesale violation of U.S. law. We do not allow others to abuse the U.S. financial system to launder money. We don't do it for the cartels. We don't do it for anybody else. But we are allowing the Chinese to do it.
Gordon, as I understand it, the consideration that seemed to have prevailed in the administration's decision was that these banks are simply so large, they're involved so massively in not only North Korea, but worldwide, that it would have had adverse effects on the international financial system. Are you unsympathetic to that concern, or is this really signaling to China that as long as it does its violations of American laws in a big way, it's assured of getting away with it?
Yeah, of course I'm sympathetic to the fallout that could occur because, yes, it will rock the global financial system. Also, we got to remember that it is pernicious to allow anyone to abuse U.S. banks this way. And so, we're in a point where we have a law, Frank. If we don't like the law, President Trump needs to go in front of the microphones, as I've said before. He needs to tell the American people that he's seeking the repeal of all U.S. money laundering laws because he's been intimidated by the Chinese. That is completely unacceptable what this administration is doing. Enforce the law or get the law repealed, but don't allow the Chinese to abuse us. And I know it will have repercussions, but unfortunately, we've got laws. And so I don't care about that, Frank. We need to make sure that people understand that the U.S. financial system has integrity and that we will enforce our laws against bad actors around the world.
Yeah. And the other possible outcome is that the Chinese decide it's not worth it to maintain these relations with the North Koreans, and they will behave differently and thereby limit the effects on the rest of the financial sector.
But, Frank, one other thing I should mention, that is that China in the last month or so has become open about violating the UN sanctions. So whatever the administration has been trying to signal to the Chinese by getting their cooperation hasn't worked. We've seen more North Korean workers show up in China's border areas. And when Xi Jinping had Kim Jong-un in Beijing at the end of last month, Chinese state media showed off the gifts that Xi gave to Kim, made this public. And those were violation of sanctions on luxury items. So the Chinese were saying to Trump, look, we're going to openly violate these sanctions because you, Trump, you're not a factor.
Well, I guess what you're saying, Gordon, is that as in so many other areas, Xi Jinping has decided that he's simply going to throw down with the United States. He's going to test our resolve in the South China Sea. He's going to proceed with relations with a whole host of unsavory nations in the pursuit of his One Belt, One Road initiative. It seems to me a neo-imperial operation, if ever there were one. And he's going to do it confident that he will be able to do so with impunity.
Well, the light bulb has gone on at the Center for Security Policy. Hopefully, we are going to see another light bulb go on at 1600 Pennsylvania.
Well, I have the benefit of the lamplighter, Gordon Chang, visiting with us each week, and I know the administration needs to be hearing from you as well. We're delighted to help facilitate that. Gordon Chang, thank you so much for the work you do. Next up, we'll speak with John Guandolo. We'll talk about the latest assaults on freedom of speech and the imposition of Sharia blasphemy laws in America. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by a man that I have known and worked with and admired for a long time. He has been roundly denounced and defamed and attacked, as have many of us, but I believe that he is doing important work in raising an alarm in our country about the threats we're facing, including from Sharia supremacism inside the United States. He brings to this mission an extraordinary background in the United States military as a force recon Marine with combat experience in Desert Storm. He was also the leader of a SWAT team for the Federal Bureau of Investigations before he became a special agent in their counterterrorism portfolio. His name, of course, is John Guandolo. He, these days, is the president and founder of Understanding the Threat, a very important organization teaching all of us, and most especially law enforcement personnel, about the dangers that we're facing from jihadists of various stripes, including inside the United States of America. John Guandolo, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Frank. Great to be with you again.
I've been tracking you, as I usually do, John, and was troubled to see that you recently experienced a concerted effort to suppress your pedagogic efforts, shall we say. This is not unique to these present times at all, but it seems to have taken a particularly ugly turn with the involvement not just of the usual suspects, the Council on American-Islamic Relations and the Southern Poverty Law Center, of what we call the Red-Green Axis, but also Antifa. Tell us a little bit about what has gone down of late and to what effect.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share this with your listeners. Well, we had a 5-city tour planned with a group called Worldview Weekend, and they host our TV show, Understand the Threat, TV and radio show. And the leader of that organization set up this 5-city tour in Des Moines, Iowa, La Crosse, Wisconsin, Green Bay, Wisconsin, Bloomington, Minnesota, Milwaukee. And we went out to Des Moines, and although there had been some material put out Wednesday before, which was Wednesday, April 4th, because the tour began the 5th of April, the Southern Poverty Law Center put out a scathing article about UTT and us, and, you know, called for people to do something. And interestingly enough, Antifa did something. I mean, I consider Antifa the surrogates of their the corrupt and terrorist supporting Southern Poverty Law Center, which has defended recently groups and entities that are part of a terrorist network here in the United States, not the least of which is Hamas doing business as CARE, which you just mentioned. And so Antifa picks up that mantle and begins calling the hotels in the venues in La Crosse, Green Bay, and Milwaukee. And we start seeing on social media them calling for all actors, both on the jihadi side and the Marxist side, the Antifa side, converging in Bloomington, Minnesota, which was going to be Sunday evening. And so we do the event in Des Moines, Iowa, Thursday. And I do encourage people to go to our YouTube channel, because we did a video, myself and Brandon House from Worldview Weekend. And then I did a video rebuking the Iowa state legislator, who's a Sharia-adherent Muslim, or also known as a jihadi, who lied and made defamatory comments. And I basically debunked each one of them in about a 30-minute video. So I encourage people to go to our YouTube channel, Understand the Threat, and watch those. Just you go to YouTube, put in Understanding the Threat, and our logo comes up. Just click it, and you'll see it right there. It'll be the top two videos. They're the last two we just did in the last several days.
Okay. What happened elsewhere in the Midwest?
Well, so what ends up happening is we have this thing in Des Moines. That's Thursday. Thursday night, we find out that Green Bay had canceled because of these phone calls from Antifa. And Friday morning, we found out Milwaukee, which was our biggest. We had 1,500 people registered for Milwaukee. And then of course, the host found out that now they were starting to drag their feet in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And so here's what happened. What we found out happened is Antifa made numerous calls to these venues. And it was a mix of calls. Some people called in and said, you shouldn't have this hate at your venue. But they also got calls saying, you know, we're going to come and protest. And the venue managers who spoke to, who said, you know, when Antifa calls and says, we're going to come protest, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize what that means. Because there's plenty of examples in the last year plus of Antifa showing up and hurting people and setting things on fire, on destroying property in other ways. And so, you know, as a hotel manager, now I do think they gave in rather quickly, but I also, like, I do understand if I'm a hotel owner or manager And I've got this group that I know is violent and I know that destroys property as a matter of course. And I've got to make that decision. That's a tough decision.
Yeah. John, it seems to me, though, what we're talking about is the threat of violence, implied if only, but nonetheless, the threat of violence, to silence American citizens exercising their right of free speech. This is unfortunately not simply a threat to our Constitution's First Amendment, of course. This is in the service of conformity to Sharia's blasphemy laws. Would you talk a little bit about, you know, Sharia and what it seeks to do to those who would give offense, as they put it, to Muslims or their Sharia doctrine?
Yes, thank you for that. And I would just say at Thursday night's presentation in Des Moines, where we had a couple hundred people and we had the Iowa state legislator in there who's a Sharia adherent Muslim, I said what I've said on your show before. We have a standing offer at Understand the Threat. If you can demonstrate something we're saying about the Muslim Brotherhood Network and their modus operandi or about Sharia, its authority in Islam and what it says that's not true, we will stop presenting it, stop teaching it, remove it from our materials, and offer the person who brings it to our attention $1,000 cash. Now, the state legislator was in the room when I said that, and he walked out of the room and shook my hand and smiled and never said a word. And yet he hammered us, saying that what we discuss is hateful and all of that, because he can't come against the facts of what we're saying, because what we're teaching comes right out of the books that they use in Islamic schools, mosques in the United States.
Including the Quran itself, of course. And John, when they can't contest the facts, the next and most effective approach is to prevent you from presenting those facts, is it not? So it really amounts to enforcing, not again, just an anti-constitutional restriction on your freedom of speech, but those Sharia blasphemy laws, which make it a capital offense, by the way, to engage in offense to Islam or its believers. Am I right?
That's right. In Islam, slander is to say anything about Islam or a Muslim that he would dislike, and it is a capital crime. And that is what you're seeing. And their tool, the hammer for the Islamic movement, obviously we witnessed it in this case, is the Marxists, is the Antifa, is the Southern Poverty Law Center. They're the tool. They're the implementation mechanism of silencing free speech because somebody doesn't like it. In this case, as you note, it's the Islamic leadership. And that is the enforcement of the Islamic law of slander.
Right. And the thing that is so troubling about this is, for a long time, as you know so well, John Guandolo, the Islamists have been able to point to the Al-Qaedas and the Islamic States and other practitioners of the violent jihad as a vehicle for that kind of suppression of freedom of speech. But now, stepping into the mix is this Marxist, radical leftist group, Antifa, to join them and help enforce their code. John Guandolo, it simply underscores the importance of the work you're doing at Understanding the Threat. I personally am very grateful to you for the teaching that you do. I've benefited from it myself. And come back to us again very soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.